Hello and welcome. Today I want to walk through a part of history that looks like a dark mirror, one that reflects not just the past, but who we still are. I'm talking about the European witch hunts and the economic undercurrents that helped set them on fire. This isn't old dust and parchment. It's a live wire running through debates about justice, truth, and power. Picture a small village 5 centuries ago. The harvest fails. Grain prices spike, a trade route shifts, and merchants stop coming. Anxiety rises. In tense times, communities look for a cause they can point to and a person they can blame. That's where accusations ignite. We often tell this story as pure religious panic, but look closer and you'll see money, land, and power at the table. In a decade of working with historians and educators on dark history, I've learned something that changed the way I read these episodes. Witch hunts weren't just superstition. They were tools, messy, brutal tools for consolidating authority in a world shaking with economic change. When property rules shifted, when new markets emerged, when old feudal bonds frayed and cash became king, people who didn't fit neatly, especially independent women, became vulnerable. Think about who got accused. Not the most powerful folks in town, but the widow who owned a patch of land. The midwife who knew plants better than the doctor. The healer outside the guild. The neighbor who inherited property instead of marrying it away. Accusations flared when the economy wobbled. Anxiety needs an outlet. It turns into suspicion, and suspicion becomes a weapon. There's a pattern in the records. Accusations spike when resources run thin. When crops fail or prices surge, you can watch fear turn into paperwork, depositions, confessions, verdicts. It wasn't random. It was convenient for those in charge. Label certain people as threats to the moral order, and suddenly you're not just cleansing evil. You're tightening your grip on land, labor, and obedience. This isn't to say religion didn't matter. It did, deeply. But faith was tangled with power. The legal machinery that grew during these centuries, the rules, the courts, the manuals, often prioritized conviction over truth. Invisible evidence. Visions, dreams, spectral claims was allowed to stand as proof. When feelings become facts, panic walks right into the courtroom. If you're in the United States, you might be thinking about Salem. The American echo was smaller, but culturally enormous. In the late 1600s, about 20 people were executed in Salem, and several others died in jail. In the decades around that, New England saw roughly 80 accusations and 15 executions. Not the hundreds or thousands Europe saw, but enough to set precedents. Spectral evidence, an invisible spirit used as testimony, was accepted. Once courts validate what can't be tested, the door swings open to hysteria. Now zoom back out to Europe. Over the course of centuries, conservative estimates put executions for witchcraft around 40 to 50,000. That's a mid-sized town of human lives. Imagine a soccer stadium of mothers, fathers, healers, farmers. Each seat a life condemned by a system that blended fear with law. Gender cuts sharply here. Roughly 4 out of 5 accused were women, especially those who didn't fit the mold. Widows, unmarried women, older women who'd outlived their husbands and controlled property, women with knowledge outside sanctioned institutions. If you ever wondered how patriarchy enforces itself, this is a case study in slow motion. The message was clear. Independent women are risky, and knowledge that flows outside official channels is suspect. Midwives and herbalists were targeted not only because they dealt in life and health, but because their skills gave them social power. Imagine being the person families turn to in crisis. What a threat to a society trying to centralize medical and moral authority. Accusing her didn't just punish the individual. It chilled a whole network. It told other women, shrink your ambitions. Be careful how visible you are. Don't step beyond the edges drawn for you. Legal systems absorbed this mindset. Manuals like the Malleus Maleficarum laid out how to identify, interrogate, and eliminate suspects. Torture was normalized. Confessions were engineered. And long after the last trial ended, habits lingered. The readiness to criminalize difference, to mistake conformity for truth, and to prioritize order over justice. We had to consciously unlearn those habits in modern law. We're still unlearning them. How do we know all this? Good researchers don't just stack facts. They read between the lines. They trace patterns that explain not only what happened, but why. It's a form of social and emotional intelligence. When you notice how fear travels, who it lands on, who benefits, you start seeing connections to the present that are hard to ignore. Because we still do this. Maybe not with witches, but with groups who look different, worship differently, or challenge economic scripts. In crises, financial crashes, pandemics, political upheavals, fear goes shopping for scapegoats. If our rules allow rumor to stand as evidence, or outrage to replace due process, the results echo those old courtrooms. We just swap the costumes. Here's a simple frame. When a community is under strain, who becomes explainable to blame? Usually the person whose existence already makes the powerful uncomfortable. Not because they caused the crisis, but because fear is a tool, and tools get used where they work. So what do we do with this dark mirror? First, name the pattern. Economic stress plus political ambition equals a risky climate for justice. Second, defend the guardrails we've built. Due process, empirical evidence, presumption of innocence. These aren't niceties. They're firebreaks against panic. Third, audit our biases about gender and authority. If the people we police most are those who are independent, unconventional, or community-trusted outside official pipelines, maybe the problem isn't them. There are quieter costs we should remember. Witch hunts hollowed social resilience. Neighbors accuse neighbors. Family split. Imagine living where everyday frustrations, your broken fence, your sick cow, your failed crop, could become charges against the woman across the lane. That's not just cruelty. It's a community taking itself apart when it most needs to hold together. There is a hopeful thread. We've tightened legal standards. We've expanded rights for the accused. We've questioned old gender scripts. The point of a dark mirror isn't to haunt us. It's to steady our footing. So the next time you feel a wave of collective fear building, ask, what's the economic story underneath? Who benefits from a tidy explanation with a convenient villain? What kind of evidence are we allowing? And would we accept it if the accused were us? I often imagine a conversation across time. A healer from the 1600s stands before a court and says, I delivered your children. I cooled your fevers. I grew plants you didn't know the names of. How did I become your enemy? And I imagine us answering, we were scared. We let fear draft the rules. We mistook order for justice. We looked for relief in the wrong place. We can do better. We can be the generation that breaks the panic-then-punish cycle. We can insist that anxiety is not an argument. We can protect people whose independence makes communities stronger. Those who carry knowledge, care, and courage without permission slips. If this sparked questions about the legal gears, the role of the Inquisition, the decline of these practices, or how ideas jump the Atlantic, there's more in the companion article. But if you remember nothing else, remember this. When the ground shakes under a society, the wiser instinct is to pause, investigate, and refuse to trade justice for certainty. Thanks for listening, and for being the kind of person who looks into the dark mirror not to be haunted by it, but to walk forward with clearer eyes.